Good morning. So I'm going to speak a little bit about one aspect of building universal health systems that's usually less spoken about. I think James is going to speak about the more generally addressed one, which is building health systems to provide care for individuals. But I want to speak about the aspects of primary prevention, and particularly through regulatory strategies, which is a rather controversial area of how you build universal health systems. I have no relationships to disclose. So non-communicable disease in the Americas basically is a really big problem, as it is throughout the world. And I think understanding the massiveness of it is a fundamental aspect of what we're going to talk about. These numbers vary a little bit from one source to another, but something between 75 and 83% of deaths in the Americas are due to non-communicable disease. 3 to 4 million deaths annually, of which close to half occur before age 70, 200 million people with one or more diseases. And when you look at the health systems, the bulk of expenditures of the health systems and the everyday activities of primary care clinics from Ottawa to Patagonia are really involved in caring for non-communicable diseases. Because of the massiveness of these conditions, whether in the United States or in Chile, they represent a threat to the sustainability, the economic and functional sustainability of health systems. Here in the United States, we have tremendous difficulty, for example, even understanding how to take care of the growing burden of cases of diabetes. This is data on diabetes mortality in selected countries. And I was used to looking at the United States curve, which if you take it in isolation, really looks terrible to us, with more than doubling of the rate of diabetes in the country and increases in mortality, although more recently we've done a little bit better. But when you look at the rates in some of the Latin American countries, the increases in diabetes mortality as a consequence of the obesity epidemic have been truly frightening, as you can see in the case of Mexico or Jamaica. And of course, this comes at a tremendous economic cost. The World Economic Forum estimated a cost between 2011 and 2030 of $46.7 trillion for taking care of just five non-communicable diseases, of which 21 million were in lower and middle income countries, with enormous economic impact. Interestingly, when you look at this burden of non-communicable diseases, four key risk factors: dietary risks, tobacco, harmful use of alcohol, and physical inactivity account for about two-thirds of new cases of non-communicable diseases, as well as for many of the complications in people who already have existing diseases. Dietary risks has the largest burden when you combine them all together, of about 1.4 million deaths in the Americas in 2010, according to the Global Burden of Disease Research. Tobacco, about 800,000, alcohol, 300,000, and physical inactivity, just under 500,000. The good news to this is that this is not the Ebola epidemic. So these are patterns of illness that are caused by mankind's behavior, and therefore potentially and optimistically can be changed more easily. Alcohol, some of these problems are getting better, some of them are getting worse. Cardiovascular disease, as Dr. Hennis has documented in some of his research, is actually improving in much of the region, particularly in North America, but also in South America. But harmful use of alcohol has increased, with a 50% increase in disability-adjusted life years between 1990 and 2010, and the second highest region in drinking rates within WHO. In the Americas, it's the most common underlying cause for risks of death in the young. When we look at dietary risks, the global burden of disease is really extraordinarily high, with over 11 million deaths, of which about 12% are in the Americas. A large part of this, we believe, is due to the transformation of our food supply in the direction of having a much heavier component of highly processed foods and beverages. This graph is the classic ecological association, not inferring causality, but these represents the increase in processed food sales in 12 countries of the Americas, and the temporal association with increased body mass in those countries. So we're seeing, if you live in Latin America, it's a very visual transformation of what's for sale in the stores, of the entry of huge international supermarket chains, and a real change in what people are eating. Some of the key dietary risks that are affecting this epidemic are salt intake, low fruit and vegetable intake, unhealthy fat intake, and added sugar, particularly from sugar-sweetened beverages. And many of these so-called ultra-processed foods are combining these elements in large quantities without having much in the way of useful nutrition. So one of the first conclusions that we reach when we're thinking about how to address non-communicable disease in countries is that it can't just be about care. We do need to provide care to people, and we need to improve our health systems, but we also need to engage effectively in primary prevention, because if we look at the data, for example, China, 50% of the population with prediabetes, United States, close to 40% of adults with prediabetes, these are just numbers that are too high to treat our way out of. Which means that we have to start addressing some of these root causes effectively. One positive thing that has been happening is that over the past decade, we've seen a real increase in the international commitments to addressing these problems, both on the side of health system care and on the side of primary prevention. And this has been reflected in a long sequence of agreements and documents and declarations, starting with the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control in 2003, followed by multiple WHO policies on diet, physical activity, harmful use of alcohol, the UN High-Level Declaration on NCDs, the subsequent action plan. PAHO recently put out its plan of action on childhood obesity, and most recently, just this fall, the incorporation of non-communicable disease into the Sustainable Development Goals. And part of this has resulted in some clear risk factor targets for addressing those risk factors I was talking about, with the goal of reducing premature mortality 25% by 2025. These include halting the rise of diabetes and obesity, which sounds easy, but no country has reversed the obesity epidemic, and so it's tremendously challenging. Reductions in salt, alcohol, tobacco use, targets for reduction of insufficient physical activity, as well as recommendations around marketing of unhealthy food to children and unhealthy fats. But when you look at WHO's, what they call their best buy interventions, what you see is that two-thirds of them are regulatory. They involve governments making laws, changing their policies, not things you can do in primary care centers, but things that you must do through regulation of the marketplace. That applies for tobacco products, for alcohol, for salt intake, for breastfeeding, and a number of others. So when we look at these groups of harmful products, tobacco, food, and alcohol in particular, we see that these products share marketing strategies, and then by implication also share regulatory strategies. They share approaches to marketing their products, to formulating their products, to setting their prices and encouraging consumption through price setting, and through the way that they place their products in our physical and social environments. This problem led PAHO to launch what's been called the Regula Initiative, which is looking at how do you regulate these non-communicable disease risks last year. Essentially based on the recognition that while regulation is a recognized part of the essential public health functions, its capacity has lagged far behind other fields of public health action. In general, it's moved forward in regulation of pharmaceuticals, and to some extent, traditional food safety challenges over the past 100 years, but the regulation of non-communicable disease risks arising from products has really lagged far behind. This resulted in a recent document on non-communicable disease risk factors in the Americas and considerations on strengthening regulatory capacity, as well as initial discussions on how to strengthen this. Part of this is the discussion of the wide range of initiatives, interventions, policies that can be used to address these risk factors, which range from educational and informational interventions towards guiding choice, financial incentives, such as subsidies, financial disincentives like taxation or other types of disincentives, restrictions of choice, or even eliminating choice, which sounds really onerous, but in fact, there are times when it's quite appropriate. So for example, trans fats, there's no reason to have them in our food supply and they can be successfully eliminated. Lead in paint was successfully eliminated. So there are appropriate moments for each one of these. Part of the work was really trying to develop a toolbox of regulatory strategies and recognize the many ways in which countries, cities, states, provinces around the region are trying to address these risk factors, which range from looking at retail practices to increase availability of healthy products and decrease availability of unhealthy ones, restrictions on actual product formulation, how much salt goes into a food, how much nicotine into a cigarette, and so forth, how much sugar into a soda, informational interventions like the graphic warning labels on cigarettes, interventions which which impact price, such as excise taxes or sales taxes, marketing restrictions which are spreading, particularly in relation to unhealthy foods, and also tobacco and alcohol, interventions around social environments like smoke-free air or what food you can serve in a workplace, which may be voluntary, they're not necessarily laws, and a series of other economic approaches, whether around transportation, land use, and so forth. These are classic health and all policies type approaches. They're not things that we can typically do in isolation through a Ministry of Health or a Department of Health. PAHO surveyed countries in the region to try and understand how they were doing in relation to non-communicable diseases. And what they found was, in general, the countries had plans. Many of these plans centered around care. There were strengths in tobacco, but weaknesses in other areas, and specifically how to address alcohol, dietary risks, physical activity was far behind some of the other issues. When most countries tax alcohol and tobacco, those taxes generally fall far short of the levels needed to successfully have an optimal impact on consumption. And many of the policies are weakly formulated or lack sufficient enforcement. I'm just going to give some examples of regulations addressing these four risk factors in the Americas that have been successful. The first and the strongest group of interventions that have really made tremendous progress arise either before or during or in the aftermath of the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. And this is truly a massive success story across the region. 30 of the 35 countries have ratified the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. Still missing are Argentina, Cuba, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and of course, the United States of America, which has not signed any of the public health agreements, I think, that back to the code on substitutes of breast milk in the 1980s. When we look at the implementation, we have seen a tremendous and successful spread of the key components of the framework convention, which are often known as empower, or the empower strategies. Roughly half of the population of the Americas is now living in areas with smoke-free air laws, with support for tobacco cessation, and with graphic warnings or strong warning labels around the risks of tobacco. The areas of restricting marketing and of providing adequate taxation are a little bit further behind in relation to the other strategies. And this has been incredibly successful. This is just one example, but like this chart, there are other examples from across the region, and rates of smoking have fallen dramatically. This is Brazil, which had a succession of increases in cigarettes taxes, had strong graphic warning labels, spreading use of smoke-free air regulations, and most recently actually banned the use of e-cigarettes altogether in Brazil. So we've seen this very steady decline in smoking rates in Brazil, in Uruguay, in many other countries across the region. So in short, this comprehensive suite of tobacco regulations works and provides an example of what we may need to do to address these other risk factors. And this approach is spreading, and it's spreading to food, which is the obvious second cause of non-communicable disease risk. And we're seeing some very successful interventions spreading across the Americas. These are two examples of front-of-pack labeling from Latin America, the first in Ecuador, which is using a traffic light approach, and the second in Chile, which is going into effect next year, which uses a very strong warning: excess of sugar, excess of sodium, excess of calories, and excess of saturated fat. That's going to be gradually implemented over the next couple of years in Chile, and I think is probably the strongest warning system. I believe Bolivia just also passed an Ecuadorian-like system this week. Soda taxes is also a strategy that's spreading rapidly throughout the region. Mexico implemented a 10% tax on soda, accompanied by a tax on junk food in 2013. Berkeley, California followed in 2014 with a 10% tax on soda. Chile had an 8% tax imposed in 2015, and Barbados passed a 10% tax in 2015. So we can ask the first question. This is just an example of the penetration of the soda industry in Mexico and Chiapas with indigenous populations. So So in Mexico, the research so far is suggesting that this strategy works. The first year of data, which was collected by Colchero and Popkin and others in Mexico, Rivera, found a 6% decrease in purchases of soda over the course of the year, which actually rose to 12% by the last month of the year. So it's a very significant, important decline in the sales of sugar-sweetened beverages as a result of a modest tax. The recommended 20% tax, which has not yet been implemented anywhere, as far as I know, would have presumably a larger impact. In Berkeley, California, and these are new results we're just releasing today, we did two studies that are still underway that will only be complete after a year's data is collected, but these are some of our interim data. We did an observation of a panel of 68 beverage products in 26 store types in December of 2014, and then again 4 months post-tax. And then the second study used sales-weighted retail scanner data from grocery stores to examine the impact both in Berkeley and in comparison cities, and covers the first 6 months of the tax. This covers about 100 million transactions, which included about 9 million transactions with beverages. This data is interim and preliminary, but our findings were, and I'm sure it's just the basic conceptual framework, is for a soda tax to be, soda tax works two ways. It raises money that can be used for useful purposes, so that's important. And the Berkeley soda tax raised about just under $700,000 in the first 6 months, or a little over a dollar per person per month. It's a small community of 100,000 people. The second way that it works is if the price is passed on to consumers, consumers presumably buy less of the product and therefore consume less. So our first question was, is the price being passed on? What we found in the first study was that the price was passed on to consumers in chain stores and partially in pharmacies, so chain supermarkets, chain gas stations, but it was not yet passed on in the small independent markets, which was not surprising because the city has not yet rolled it out to those environments. It's worked primarily with the large distributors to date. So there was a mean price change. The tax was 1 cent per ounce, and the price changed by 1.32 cents. In large supermarkets, 1.65 in small chain supermarkets, 2.71, so higher than the tax in chain gas stations, but was not in the other establishments. The data using sales-weighted retail scanner data on the 100 million transactions similarly found that the taxes were passed on. In the first month of the tax, the sales-weighted prices for tax beverages rose by 0.5 to 0.76 cents per ounce, and by month six, that had risen to 1.4 to 1.7 cents per ounce. So it rose above the tax amount, which would have been 1 cent per ounce. It rose more on small packages, so the industry is making a lot more money on the smaller sodas. And it did vary, as I mentioned from the first study, across establishments. These results are consistent across our two studies and also with a smaller study that UC Berkeley did. So I think what we're seeing is that the tax is working, at least in regard to pass-through. We will have more complete results after a year, both on sales and on consumption. Another important example from the Americas is salt, is regulation of salt, which in Argentina, for example, has advanced through voluntary targets and mandatory maximum. Similarly in Paraguay, with voluntary salt reduction initiatives in Brazil, Canada, Chile, and Mexico, the Mercosur Common Market adopted common targets. And these efforts are way ahead of the US FDA, which after 40 years of being petitioned on salt has still not acted. So Latin America is charging ahead. On trans fat, Argentina beat us to it in 2010 with a ban on trans fat, and the U.S. followed in 2015. One question that arises from this is, do we need a global framework convention for healthy and sustainable food similar to the framework convention on tobacco control? I won't enter into detail on this discussion here, but I would say that there is a growing movement that is saying yes to this idea. In alcohol, similarly, I can't get into details here, but there's a whole framework of intervention strategies that also involve many regulatory approaches. The green stars are regulatory approaches. And this is just one illustration from a small city in São Paulo, the Adema, that told bars that they had to close after 11 p.m. And just that simple policy action by a city had a huge impact on homicides, road accidents, domestic violence assaults, and alcohol-related hospital admissions while improving the business environment, and it spread to 120 cities. Similarly, in physical activity, we are looking at trying to spread policies that increase active transportation, both for reasons of physical activity and for environmental sustainability. There's been an important spread of open street expansions across the Americas, and I think a growing movement to look at sustainable public transportation methods. What are some of the barriers? I think we see important barriers. Health system staff, for starters, are not generally trained as regulators. So the impetus to come from the health system to successfully regulate these risk factors involves training and developing new skills within our health systems that are still very weak. Second, and probably most importantly, is the political will to take on the huge economic interests involved. And that means creating that political will on the part of governments, but also advancing understanding of civil society and the community of these issues and why they are important to address. Because if you don't work both of those sides simultaneously, you often fail. And third is the funding of regulatory activities, which traditionally has been a very weakly funded part of our health systems. So even though they may have tremendous return on investment in terms of protection of health, there's very little primary investment. Second is the food and alcohol industry is really taking on the historic behaviors of the tobacco industry and opposing regulation extremely aggressively through a series of strategies that WHO and others have documented, exaggerating the economic importance of the industry and the negative impact of regulation, manipulating public opinion, developing front groups, trying to discredit the science around these risk factors and regulatory approaches, and threatening litigation. I, by myself, have answered a number of lawsuits trying to block regulatory measures around non-communicable disease, and it's tiring. The other system that's being used to really block and intimidate efforts at regulation is the trade regulations internationally. Just to give one example, for example, the United States Trade Representative filed a complaint with the World Trade Organization in relation to Chile's wonderful front-of-pack labeling system. In the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there have been a huge component of debates around tobacco regulation, and while some progress was made on tobacco, the ability to defend regulations around food and other areas is still a precarious and a difficult one. So there's a very important role to be played of working with countries around their trade negotiations to establish strong protections for public health. So just looking forward, really systematically addressing the reduction of risks from these NCD risk factors will be an important part of reducing premature mortality from non-communicable disease. Really working to strengthen the stewardship function within governments and helping to level the playing field between these private economic interests and the broader societal interests will be very important. PAHO has proposed to work to evaluate the existing regulatory and planning capacity within ministries of health as well as the legal frameworks and to strengthen organizational development for regulatory capacity within health systems, which they've already been doing with pharmaceuticals, but we need to do equally with NCD risk factors. And I would add, strengthening the capacity of civil society is a very important piece of being successful with these efforts. So in short, how people age, and whether they age independently and healthfully, or whether they age burdened by many chronic diseases, will in large part depend on how well we're able to change our environments to address these risk factors. So we'll be taking questions later. Regula is an initiative at PAHO, which we've worked providing some consultancy on, and the Berkeley Evaluation of Soda Tax is a study of PHI together with the University of North Carolina. Thank you.